Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And the thing that I'm going to talk about today, or the person I'm going to talk about today in particular, is Thomas Edward Lawrence, better known as Lawrence of Arabia. Perhaps the most mythologised British soldier of the 20th century. Immortalised, of course, in David Lean's 1962 film Lawrence of Arabia, starring Peter O'Toole and Omar Sharif. The film was obviously an enormous success and has become one of the kind of the landmarks of epic British filmmaking in the post-war era. But part of its success was the fact that nearly 50 years after the First World War, the mid-60s, particularly in Britain, saw a renewed interest in the war and in interpretations of the war. And it saw a renewed interest in examining different aspects of the war, and the war in the Middle East was largely overshadowed by the Western Front and the memory of the Western Front. The popularity of Lawrence as a figure, I think, stems from the fact that our overwhelming narrative about the Western Front is one of futility and tragedy and wasted youth, whereas the war in the Middle East is a far more mobile affair, and it's not one without its failures and disasters, such as Kut Anamara and Gallipoli. But certainly, by the time of the Arab Revolt from 1916 onwards, the tide is turning against the Ottoman Empire, and the exploits of T.E. Lawrence were the stuff of exciting legend. You know, here was a man of extraordinary qualities who was able to bring about a guerrilla attack, guerrilla warfare on the Ottoman Empire. The extent of his, the significance of his struggles against the Ottoman Empire are, well, perhaps questionable, but we'll talk about that more in a moment. An interesting thing to note is in 1918, at the end of the war, nobody had heard of him. That is, nobody in Great Britain anyway. He was an obscure army officer with nothing really to attract public attention. So in a way, the story of T.E. Lawrence is as interesting from a point of view of the development of modern media and modern notions of fame and celebrity as it is for his tales of derring do in the desert. So he was born in 1888, and he was a figure that you see in a number of different guises throughout the on the periphery of the English kind of upper middle to upper classes in the 20th century. Someone who is halfway establishment, but also has has a sense of the outsider to them. He was born in Tremadog in Wales. His father was an Anglo-Irish gentry, an officer who had run off with another woman, run off with a governess who had been employed to look after his first children, And they have an illegitimate son in Tremadog in Wales. And they rename themselves the Lawrences. So Thomas Lawrence was a kind of quite an eccentric figure, an Arabist, and he developed his love of the Arab culture at Oxford University. He went with the British Museum to Syria in the 3 years from 1911 to 1914 and worked on excavation digs there. And there he became fluent in Arabic. And he was sent to Cairo in 1914. He was one of these academic types that British intelligence say are very kind of ad hoc and often kind of say amateurish outfit at the time. Thought, well, you seem like a clever chap and you can speak the language of the Arabs and we're probably going to be at war with the Ottomans fairly soon, off you go. And in November 1914, that indeed happens, and the Ottoman Empire declares war on the Allied powers. And the plans that the intelligence units surrounding Lawrence had was to see if they could use the Arab tribes to rise up against the Ottomans. Now, this wasn't a new idea. Kitchener, in 1910, had wondered whether this would be possible, believing that the Arabs were the Ottomans' kind of Achilles' heel. And the conversations that had been going on between the British and the Arabs had been conducted between the British and Sharif Hussein of Mecca. Sharif Hussein of Mecca would have been happy to overthrow the Ottomans, not so much out of nationalist principles. The Sharif was a key part of the establishment of the empire. He had grown up in close proximity to the Ottoman leadership and supported them for the most part. He was a religious conservative figure and was deeply opposed to the modernisation and liberalisation of the Ottoman Empire. He did not like the Tanzimat reforms and was opposed to the rule of the Pashas, and believed that an independent Hejaz, which was the western seaboard of what is now Saudi Arabia, or even an independent Arab kingdom, might be able to preserve Islam in a more purified form. Now, you see, again and again throughout the First World War, great powers using national minorities to cause others an immense amount of trouble. The Germans attempt to fund the Easter Rising and arm it. The Germans also send revolutionaries back to Russia after February 1917. And so this was a kind of a well-understood ploy. The extent to which the Middle East was seen as a backwater by the chiefs of the General Staff of the British Army can be shown really through kind of Lawrence's efforts and the small underfunded team that he had. But the significance of the Middle East to the British, particularly their control of Egypt, was never more important than it was by the time of about 1916. The British had sent the British government in 1914 had sent for Sir Mark Sykes, the only person that Lloyd George, Kitchener and the War Cabinet could lay their hands on in a short space of time, who seemed remarkably knowledgeable about the Middle East. And he was part of the process of crafting the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was the initial understanding about the carve-up of the Ottoman Empire after the end of the First World War. So gradually, as the First World War goes on, strategically, the Ottoman Empire and the Middle Eastern theatre becomes more important, but it never becomes anything more than an afterthought in the eyes of people like Haig, people like Haig sneer at, and Robertson and French, they sneer at the politicians and diplomats and military thinkers who look to the Middle Eastern theatre and refer to them as the Easterners. And there's a kind of a sense that this was a sideshow of a sideshow, and that the main fighting needed to be done on the Western Front. The disaster at Gallipoli in 1915 shows to the Western Fronters that the Easterners are really barking up the wrong tree. But the thing to remember is that the Middle East was really the gateway between the East and the West, from Britain to her Asian empire. And any disruption to this was potentially fatal. If Britain was cut off from India or Australia, then all manner of catastrophes might ensue. So it really was a very important part of the world. And after the ascendancy in 1916 of David Lloyd George to the Prime Minister's office, a new kind of crusade takes shape, in that Lloyd George believed, partly on a kind of a Christian or religious level, but mainly on an imperial level and an empire building level, that the British Empire should expand into the Ottoman Empire, that Palestine should be controlled by Great Britain, and that certainly Mesopotamia, and specifically Mosul in the north, where it was understood there to be oil, that should be controlled by the British as well. And so Lloyd George in 1916 introduces an entirely new strategic dimension to the war, and one of the war goals is finally expanding an empire into the Middle East, under the cover, I suppose, of mandates at the end of the war. And this is indeed what happens. So the conflict in the Middle East threatens the British Empire. The Ottomans tried to seize the Suez Canal, and so in June 1916, Sharif Hussein of Mecca launches the Arab Revolt. Lawrence formed a strong friendship with Prince Faisal, one of Sharif Hussein's sons, and Lawrence's great achievement, for which he is immortalised in the film Lawrence of Arabia, is the seizure of the port of Aqaba on the Red Sea in July.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
1917. Sir Edmund Allenby, commander-in-chief of the British-led Egyptian Expeditionary Force, saw potential in the Arab Revolt. The Arab Revolt was prior to this point seen, again, as a sideshow of a sideshow, some real irrelevance. But Allenby believed that it could help him. And he was willing at this point, because of the strategic value of the Arab revolt, to arm and equip the Arabs with the supplies that they need to wage a full guerrilla war. And Aqaba is sort of almost Lawrence's publicity stunt. It's the thing that he does to show to the British, look, there is potential in these warriors. Part of their appeal, of course, the Bedouins, is that they were quite cheap. You know, the thing as well about the Ottoman control of Arabia is that it couldn't be done without railways. You know, deserts are difficult things to cross and difficult things to police. The Bedouin know how to do it. They've lived in the desert for centuries. And the Ottomans were constrained by the use of railways, especially if you blow the railway lines up. Lawrence spends the rest of the war conducting guerrilla raids, destroying railways and disrupting communications between Turkish lines, and this coincides with Allenby's final assault on Damascus. The myth of Lawrence of Arabia began by the works of an American journalist, Lowell Thomas. He'd met him in 1918. He'd filmed him as part of an American propaganda drive. The American audiences and the American war propaganda services needed to have a hero, and so they combed really the different theatres of war to find somebody quite remarkable. And Lowell Thomas, at the end of the war, really gives talks about his journeys with the British Army in Palestine, and the lecture was called "With Allenby in Palestine and Lawrence in Arabia." And all of a sudden, this extraordinary figure begins to emerge in Lowell Thomas's writing. And he took his tour not only to America, but also to Britain. And it's really in about 1919 that the Lawrence myth begins. There was a show on the Royal Albert Hall in August 1919. And it is sensational, and it is exciting. And the film is made of Lawrence's life, a kind of an early black and white documentary that's seen seen all the way around the world. About 4 million people watch it, and it is referred to initially as the Blonde Bedouin, and it kind of fits in with a lot of the black and white silent films that were happening at the time. There is something deeply unattractive, obviously, about the memories of the trenches, which were unpleasant things to think about. The Arab revolt was an exciting venture, and it was a war of movement and ingenuity and daring and the kind of things that people think war should be. But also, kind of, Lawrence was quite an attractive man. He was part of the new culture of the movies, really, that was shaping itself in the early 1920s. And it's no coincidence that in 1921, the silent movie star Rudolph Valentino has a massive hit with the film The Sheik, which was a kind of laden with ideas of kind of Orientalism and exoticism and sensuality and sexuality, all these kinds of things. Lawrence was had a kind of a conflicted reaction to his fame. He was an extremely egotistical man, a terrible narcissist. And many of his kind of exploits during wartime suggest this, but he also is extremely shy, and sort of he was, rejected his fame. He wanted to find a quiet life now in the Royal Air Force, which he joined and served in India, And then he adopted a pseudonym. He didn't want to be recognised, but he was quite obsessed with his own image. The press wanted to find out more about him, though. He was quite an intriguing figure. And in his newfound fame and status, he got to meet some quite influential figures and had some quite influential admirers. So not only did he become friends with Winston Churchill, but people such as George Bernard Shaw, W.H. Auden, Christopher Isherwood, and Thomas Hardy all became admirers of him, along with Kathleen Scott, who was the widow of Robert Falcon Scott, Scott of the Antarctic, who no doubt, had he lived a couple of years longer, would have been perhaps engaged in similar tales of derring do on the Western Front. So he was able to kind of craft and control his public image. And he wrote his book in 1926, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which eventually becomes the abridged book, The Revolt in the Desert. And he's one of these figures, again, like Churchill, whose wartime exploits are carefully managed and controlled in order to present a particular version of events. You know, he knew that he would be chief in making his own myth. And it was Lawrence, you know, he plays up his role in the Arab Revolt. But it also offers all sorts of insights about his sexuality, his attraction to men, the accounts of him being tortured after he was captured by the Turks. And again, this adds partly adds to the myth. He suffered the fate of all kind of legends, really. He died early. He was killed in 1935 in a motorcycle accident, and so he's really elevated to that kind of level of the tragic hero that, you know, did good by his nation. It's sort of somewhat not dissimilar to Nelson in that kind of level of adoration, and he is indeed immortalized at St. Paul's Cathedral, where there's a bronze bust in his likeness. One of the impressions that you get about T.E. Lawrence from the writings of James Barr, and if you haven't read his book Line in the Sand, it really is a very good read indeed, is that from time to time you have this largely autonomous and egomaniacal and almost kind of out of control figure making up British policy in the Middle East as he goes along. He's determined to prevent the French from taking Damascus, for example. He had a deep loathing of the French. He was had a deep affection for the Arabs that he fought with, and definitely believed that an Arab nation should emerge at the end of the war, as they had been suggested that might happen. The actual promises made by the British in the McMahon letters, the McMahon correspondence between Sir Thomas McMahon in Egypt and Sharif Hussein of Mecca, implied strongly that the British would support the emergence of a unified Arab nation. And at the end of the war, obviously that's not what happens. By the 1920s, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has emerged, but Arabia does not include Syria, Iraq, or Mesopotamia at the time, Transjordan, or Palestine. These are hived off as mandates. And so it means that the Arabia that was originally envisaged fails to emerge, even though Lawrence himself attends the Paris Peace Conference negotiations as part of Faisal's delegation in 1919. And it's interesting that the end of the war seems to have been kind of the metaphorical death of Lawrence, really. He goes and does some work for Churchill at the Colonial Office, and he attempts to join the tank corps, and he joins the RAF, and he then retires and enjoys activities such as speedboat racing and motorcycle racing. But he seems to have kind of drifted from one thing to another and never really had the core sense of self that he achieved whilst fighting in the Arab Revolt. And I guess this is an experience that veterans occasionally or periodically have, where the most exciting moments of their lives, when they felt most a kind of coherent sense of being a person, is past them. And all sorts of question marks about identity and about the role he had in the world were unresolved. And the sense you have of Lawrence, really, when he dies, is something of an unfinished life. So there you go. So there's an interesting interface, isn't there? Interaction between the mechanical processes, and sometimes often mundane ones, of fighting war, and the creation of myth, fantasy, and legend surrounding individuals and surrounding particular events. And often the myth-making does more to kind of shape popular culture and national identity than the actual events in themselves. So anyway, I hope you found that useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.